bottom line, George, it's a terrible situation that's going on in India and other low and middle income countries. And there is more we can do. And I believe you will see shortly that all these things that we're talking about are on the table, and we will be moving towards that.
Dr. Anthony Fauci speaking with ABC's George Stephanopoulos yesterday about the COVID-19 outbreak in India, now the global epicenter of the pandemic. The Biden administration announced yesterday it plans to send the country more medical aid, like raw vaccine materials and ventilators. Today, it said the U.S. will send around 60 million doses of AstraZeneca's vaccine to other countries, also likely including India. To call the situation in India right now dire would be an understatement. For four straight days, that country has broken the global daily record for new cases. But experts say the actual number of new infections is probably a lot higher than the official estimate. The country's healthcare system is collapsing. Hospitals are running out of oxygen. The morgues are full. Here to talk about what's going on and how the Biden administration's actions could help is Yasmeen Serhan. She is staff writer for The Atlantic based in London. Welcome to Press Play.
Thanks for having me.
So the country reported around 350,000 new cases yesterday. So just in one day, that's a global record. It outpaces the highest day of the surge here in the United States. Do we know what's driving this?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the narrative was that the pandemic is on its way out. And I think India is proving that that's most certainly not the case. As for what's driving this, you know, I think it was a perfect storm of several factors. On the one hand, you had new and existing variants and a lack of robust genome sequencing in India to track them. The Indian government said that they've identified the UK variant, the Brazilian variant, the South African variant, as well as a new double mutant variant, which has been identified in India, which is believed to be behind a lot of the surges in many of the states in the country. We've also seen a continuous stream of political rallies and religious gatherings, photos from which are, you know, just quite extraordinary. There's no social distancing, no mask wearing. So you effectively have a lot of super spreader events taking place. And finally, I think there was just a general complacency on the part of the Indian government, which was relatively pretty slow to respond to a crisis to which they had already claimed victory. You know, just last month, the country's health minister declared that India was in the end game of the pandemic. And today, as you rightly noted, it's the global epicenter. So a lot can change in just a few weeks.
Right. And that's just what's so astonishing about this, how quickly this seems to have happened. Meanwhile, let's talk about the vaccination situation. India is known as the world's vaccine maker, the biggest maker of vaccines, and yet only about 1.5% of the country's population is fully vaccinated. So why the discrepancy there? If they're making so much vaccine, why haven't they been able to get more of their population vaccinated?
It's a good question. I mean, as you rightly noted, India, it's home to the largest vaccine maker in the world, the Serum Institute. But the Serum Institute isn't just in charge of making vaccines for India. It's a huge contributor to COVAX, which is the international initiative aimed at equalizing vaccine distribution around the world, particularly for low and middle income countries. So really, India is a vaccine hub for the entire world, not just itself. And it's been taking part in a lot of vaccine diplomacy, sharing doses with many of its neighbors in the region. But now, given the difficulty of the crisis that India is facing, the Serum Institute is turning its production predominantly to just focus on its domestic needs, which is actually really bad news for the rest of the world, because even though it's understandable, you know, 92 low and middle income countries who are part of COVAX are counting on India for their vaccine supply. So what we have here is a crisis that isn't just affecting India, but the rest of the world.
Right. So 1.3 billion people in India, that's a lot of vaccine that they need. So they can't make enough, obviously, to vaccinate all of their population. And now are they relying on the United States? The United States says it will send some raw materials to make the AstraZeneca vaccine. Are they relying now on the United States and other countries in Europe to send them vaccine?
Yeah, I mean, they're hoping to ramp up their production capacity. At the moment, I think India can produce around 70 million doses a month. But that, as you rightly note, that's far short, I think, of what it needs to inoculate its population of 1.3 billion. The head of the Serum Institute had appealed to the Biden administration to lift the export ban on raw materials that are used to make the vaccines. That was a request that was made a couple of weeks ago and one that was heeded by the Biden administration yesterday. But yes, I mean, you know, I'm sure that, you know, any help that the world would be willing to give India would probably be looked on quite favorably. And the announcement today from the Biden administration, I imagine, would be very welcome. This announcement that they're going to give 60 million doses, a chunk of which I would imagine would probably go to India, but we don't know yet.
Mm-hmm. Of course, this is a humanitarian need, but also a self-interested one on the part of the Biden administration, right? Because if this double mutant vaccine, this double mutant version of COVID spreads to the United States, is it possible that people who are already vaccinated or who have already gotten COVID could then get it with this double mutant?
That's what scientists are trying to find out. And indeed, it's already made it to the United States. It's already made it to Britain. It's made it to at least 10 countries. And I think what the lesson that India has taught the world, and other outbreaks in Brazil and South Africa and Britain indeed have proven as well, is that this pandemic doesn't end anywhere until it ends everywhere. So long as there's an outbreak where variants are allowed to emerge and spread, there will be a threat. So yes, it's 100%, though there is a compelling moral reason for the world and the U.S. to act, there is a self-interested one as well, and it's to ensure mm-hmm. that these variants don't emerge and hopefully don't evade the vaccine. As for whether the double mutant variant does, I think that's for scientists to say, but certainly there have been concerning reports of people who have been vaccinated already who are appearing in India's hospitals. So that's definitely a concern.
And so what is the situation in the hospitals? And there's been wide reporting that there is a lack of oxygen. Are people dying because they can't get oxygen? There's just not enough supply of oxygen?
To see the photos and the videos that are coming out of India right now, particularly on Twitter, is just devastating, really, because it's exactly that. I mean, you're seeing people who can't even get into the hospitals. And even when they do get in there, there's, you know, perhaps 45 minutes, maybe an hour of oxygen supply. So, yeah, I mean, there's, you know, it's the case where their health system is being overrun. This is something that we've seen throughout the pandemic, but it's just particularly grave there. And even the morgues. I mean, you know, there's no space anywhere. So it's really just a devastating situation. And, you know, right now the concern is that there aren't enough beds, but there will come a time when there are no beds at all.
Wow. And this is affecting young people as well, right? This is a young population in India.
That's what's so concerning. The public health experts I spoke to kind of noted that what's perhaps most concerning is that, you know, it's young people who, you know, are kind of thought to be more resilient who are coming down with COVID. You know, part of the reason for that might be that they happen to be, you know, the segment of the population that are more out and about and doing things, seeing their friends. But yeah, it's definitely a concern. I think, you know, what's happening in India really proves that this virus can affect anyone.
Right. And so are people heeding another lockdown? Are they staying away and from all of these large religious and political gatherings?
I mean, one would hope so. I know that the Indian government is quite reluctant to impose a lockdown because the last time they did, it impacted the most vulnerable and poor of the population the most. It was quite difficult to do in a population of that size as well, particularly if there's no economic support to help the population. I mean, you know, in the U.S., people were receiving stimulus checks. Here in Britain, there were furlough schemes. India doesn't have the means to do that. It's the second most populous country in the world. So hopefully there will be more adherence to mask wearing, to social distancing. And hopefully with the help and aid of other countries, India will be able to bring what has truly been a wall, not even a wave. It's just shot up both infections and death rates. Hopefully they'll be able to bring that down.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's hope so. Yasmin Sirhan, staff writer for The Atlantic. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Turning now to President Biden's historic announcement over the weekend, officially recognizing the massacre of Armenians under the Ottoman Empire as a genocide. Saturday marked 106 years since the beginning of that massacre, in which 1.5 million people died. Here to talk about the significance of Biden's statement is Anne Karagozian. She's the director of the Promise Armenian Institute at UCLA. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
Well, this is the first time a U.S. president has labeled this massacre a genocide. Why has it taken so long?
Of course, there has been a great deal of lobbying over decades by the Republic of Turkey. They do not recognize these killings to any significant degree, certainly not labeling them as genocide, which has certain legal implications. And prior presidents, even those who have promised when they campaigned for the presidency and promised that they would recognize what happened to the Armenians as genocide, they have been dissuaded from doing so. So we very much welcome President Biden's declaration on the day, April 24, Armenian Genocide Remembrance Day, and calling what happened to the Armenians a genocide. This is quite significant.
Can you remind us what happened 106 years ago? What happened to the Armenians who were living in what is now modern day Turkey?
So the Armenian population of Eastern Anatolia in particular had resided there for thousands of years, actually. And so when the Ottoman Empire was created, the Armenians continued to live there in relative harmony with the Turkish people. But it wasn't until the late 1800s that the Sultan began to impose policies in which the Armenians were massacred, were killed in large numbers in their communities. And then later this culminated in 1915 by a policy of the Young Turks group to actually systematically murder, and there is extensive documentation for this, the Armenian population. The leadership were rounded up on April 24, 1915, taken from their homes, driven out to the deserts. And this is what happened throughout Eastern Anatolia, through historic Armenia. Many of our ancestors were driven from their homes, men, women, children, and forced out onto these long marches, not given food, shelter, and died there. The men systematically were murdered. Those especially who had been conscripted into the military in Turkey. So it eventually culminated in this wholesale slaughter over a period of approximately 8 years of the Armenian population there. 1.5 million Armenians are thought to have been killed during that period.
And Turkey, of course, has strenuously denied that it has committed genocide and has denied the numbers and has also said that Turks died in this period as well. What does it mean now for the United States to have labeled this a genocide for Turkey?
Well, it's a little bit complicated. Certainly, this is an important message for the United States to send, especially if there is going to be a renewed emphasis on human rights and the rights of indigenous populations and so forth. So, you know, the present day Republic of Turkey is the successor to the Ottoman Empire. Even soon after the establishment of the Republic of Turkey, there was denial by the leadership of what happened and an attempt to cover this up. Certainly the extraordinary assets that were seized by that government that belonged to the Armenian people is what financially built the new republic. So the relationship between the United States and Turkey is one that has been, you know, relatively cooperative over the past several decades. They are still officially allies. They're still officially members of NATO, but it's become certainly much more complicated with the pivot that the current leadership of Turkey, especially President Erdogan, has taken in recent years.
Right. So even though Turkey is a NATO member, this does seem to raise the question of where are Turkey's alliances, and is it a strategic problem, a strategic threat for the West and for the United States?
Yes, indeed. I mean, it's a very complicated situation, as I mentioned. It's definitely a threat to the West with respect to military assets that the United States and other countries have in Turkey. And moreover, it's, you know, they're trying to play two sides of the coin, so to speak, you know, maintain some relations with the West, but also with Russia. And certainly there are complications associated with Syria, with what has happened to the Kurdish population there, with the withdrawal of U.S. troops there that abandoned the Kurds who were, you know, allies of the United States. You know, it's mind-boggling, the complexity here. But this day, this declaration by President Biden is something that is, irrespective of these complexities, is something that really warms the heart of the Armenian Americans, many of whom have had families living in this country for over 100 years, including mine, that there finally is this recognition of what happened and categorization of this event as genocide. You know, Raphael Lemkin was the first to coin the term genocide as he studied what had happened to the Jewish people during the Holocaust, during World War II, but he identified what happened to the Armenians during World War I as the same kind of thing. So this word was actually crafted to describe in part what happened to the Armenians.
Well, thank you very much. Really fascinating history. And thank you for coming on the show today.
You're very welcome.
That's Anne Karagozyan. She's director of the Promise Armenian Institute at UCLA. Coming up, the case of the cussing cheerleader. The Supreme Court will decide whether a school can regulate the speech of students off campus. And the court agrees to hear a major gun case. We'll talk about that next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. A terrifying moment in Tulsa during last summer's protests over the murder of George Floyd. Caught on tape by a local news crew during a demonstration on an interstate highway.
Oh, God!
Some cars are coming through the crowd right now.
My boyfriend.
It's all right. It's okay. It's a large trailer has gone through. He just went through the crowd.
The driver of that truck and horse trailer says he sped up because he feared for his family's safety. Several people were injured. One person was paralyzed in that incident. The driver was not charged. Well, last week, Oklahoma's Republican governor signed a bill that would protect drivers who unintentionally injure or kill protesters. Florida's governor, Ron DeSantis, signed similar legislation. It's part of a wave of bills in red states designed to limit protests. And we're going to talk about this now with Jessica Levinson, Loyola Law School professor and our regular Legal Eagle here on Press Play. Hi.
Hi.
Well, first of all, just give us a broad overview. Where are these bills happening and what do they do?
Well, I think they do exactly what you just said, which is that they can punish people for protesting and or protect those who interfere with protests and arguably punish people for exercising their First Amendment rights to lawfully assemble and to speak. And so where are these laws? Well, they are being introduced by Republican lawmakers in 34 states. I believe there are 81 of these so-called anti-protest laws. Depending on your perspective, sometimes they're called anti-riot laws. I think that they are more realistically called anti-protest laws. And we're seeing them, for instance, in Florida, in Oklahoma, Indiana, Minnesota, and they have basically kind of two different kinds of flavors. One is increasing penalties for those who are engaged in public disorder. So, for instance, in Florida, more penalties for people who take down monuments. In Oklahoma, in Indiana, more of these penalties for people who are engaged in protests. Minnesota would prohibit anyone convicted of unlawful protesting from getting housing assistance, employment benefits, or student loans. So it's the government trying to say you want to engage in a protest, and if it crosses the line to a so-called unlawful protest, then we're going to take public benefits away from you.
And how do you define an unlawful protest?
That is a great question. So obviously we want to give protests a lot of First Amendment breathing room, because that is arguably what we're most worried about when it comes to censorship, because we can understand why the government would want to say, can you stop doing that? It's making us look bad. Oftentimes protests are criticizing what the government action, what the government's doing. So what's an unlawful protest? It's a protest where there's disorder, where there's rioting, where there's property damage, where there's damage to other individuals. It probably bears repeating that the vast majority, that this is coming on the heels of the protests over the summer, and the vast majority were peaceful. There were, of course, some very highly publicized moments where there were, in fact, property damage, people were harmed. And so those are instances where you do cross the line and you can punish people for their behavior.
But you could do that anyway, right? I mean, you don't need special legislation to do that.
Absolutely. And such a good point, which is there is already legislation on the books. There are already crimes that say you can't engage in a riot. You can't destroy property. You can't hurt people. That's what's called assault or battery. Right. And so what some of these laws do is they just increase the penalties for things that were already punishable. And some of the laws would protect people who, again, might harm protesters or interfere with a protest. So it's kind of two sides of the same activity coin. But you're exactly right that there are already laws on the books to prevent against unlawful behavior. This, you know, again, property damage or hurting other people.
Right. So could these laws withstand a challenge on First Amendment grounds? The First Amendment is pretty clear on the rights to for people to speak and to lawfully assemble and, quote unquote, petition the government. You can protest.
You can protest. So I think nobody's going to be happy with this answer, but it depends, right? I mean, so about 36 different bills pending. They all have slightly different flavors. They all have slightly different punishments. But I think your point is exactly right, which is we have a tradition in our country, a very robust First Amendment protection, particularly when it comes to petitioning the government, when it comes to assembling, when it comes to speech, when it comes to, again, political speech, the right to protest. This is the fundamental part of the First Amendment. So the one thing we know is there will absolutely be challenges.
Okay, speaking of the First Amendment, the Supreme Court is going to hear the case of the cursing cheerleader. It's not a Nancy Drew mystery. But so it's going to hear these oral arguments on the docket for Wednesday. Give us the details of this case.
So this deals with, it's actually, as you mentioned, it's a serious First Amendment case. I mean, it has, we kind of giggle a little bit about the facts, but this brings up really fundamental questions about how broad our First Amendment protection is and how much authority public school administrators have to punish off-campus speech. That's what this case comes down to. So it involves a cheerleader from Pennsylvania who at the time in 2017 was in high school, and she tried out for the high school varsity cheerleading team. She didn't make it. She was put on the junior varsity team. She was unhappy about this, so she posted on social media. And the post on social media included her holding up her middle finger and then using the F word in reference to her school, to softball, to cheerleading, and then I think she said basically to everything. Her coaches saw this and they said, okay, you're off the team. You're suspended for a year. Her father, with the help of the ACLU, sued, and that's how this case has kind of, at this point, made its way up to the Supreme Court. And again, that big question is, we know public school administrators have some authority when it comes to punishing on-campus speech. And but we don't know exactly what the scope is when it comes to punishing what this would be, which is off-campus speech. She posted on social media on her own time, not during school hours.
Well, I can see the complications in this case because there could be instances where students, and there have been instances where students promise violence or they are bullying other students off campus and not during school hours that schools would have an interest in regulating or preventing or punishing.
Absolutely. And I think that cyberbullying and even disinformation when it comes to social media, these will be the new frontiers that the Supreme Court has to tackle. Now, the Biden administration did submit a friend of the court, meaning an amicus brief, saying, no, let's keep cyberbullying basically in its own lane and let's just try and address this issue. What I would say is that that's easier said than done. And depending on where the Supreme Court wants to go, which we'll hear on Wednesday, they could try and blur those lines and say, well, look, regulation can bleed over into a lot of cases, or they'll say, no, we can keep those things separate.
Okay, finally, the court announced today it's going to hear a big gun case in the fall. And this is whether or not people will have to prove why they need to have a concealed carry permit and why they should be allowed to bring their guns into public spaces.
Yeah, this is the case that gun control advocates have been dreading and that proponents of a broader reading of the Second Amendment have been waiting for. There is a 6-3 solid conservative majority on the Supreme Court. This is a law dealing with, as you said, New York requiring residents to show very specifically that they have a need for a concealed carry permit. And this is the progeny. This is like the child of that famous case from, I believe, 2007, the Heller case, where the late Justice Scalia said there is an individual right under the Second Amendment to bear arms. And this case is going to ask those unanswered questions. And it's, again, it's the case that people on both sides of the divide have either been waiting for or dreading. It's going to be one of the biggest cases. And of course, it's against the backdrop of this continued growth in mass shootings across the country.
Jessica, thank you.
Thank you.
Jessica Levinson, Loyola Law School professor and our regular Legal Eagle here on Press Play. Coming up, why 1991 was a key year for rock music. Critic Eric J. Lawrence remembers meeting the guys in Nirvana right before they hit it big.
I don't know exactly what teen spirit is supposed to smell like, but those dudes were the stinkiest guys I ever encountered.
The year grunge took over. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, in 1991, radio stations across the country didn't know it yet, but they were shuffling through records that would go on to define the hard rock sound of the decade, pushed by college radio stations looking to buck pop music trends in favor of something, well, a little grungier. Bands like Nirvana, Red Hot Chili Peppers, and Metallica all released albums that were not only massive hits, but now, 30 years later, are still some of the most influential rock records of all time. KCRW music critic Eric J. Lawrence was the music director at UCLA's radio station in 1991, and he joins me now to talk about some of the iconic albums of that year. Hi there. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Madeline.
Wow, 30 years. I'm feeling my age.
Yes, you and me
wow.
both.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so there you were getting into the radio scene at UCLA, and how were you getting your music at the time and deciding what to play?
So at the time, there was sort of a distinction. This was at an era when they called it college rock as opposed to alternative rock. And for college rock, most record labels had a college department, and they would actually have a specific representative that would send out copies to all of the college radio stations across the country. And we would just simply gather all of these records and we'd listen to them all and kind of make decisions about the records that we thought were going to be of greatest interest to be played at the station. And most stations had a sort of something of a format that you kind of followed more in the lines of kind of commercial radio versus a completely free form radio like a KCRW has. Mm-hmm. And that was just sort of using this as a laboratory. If any of us were interested in getting into commercial radio, this was the way it was done.
Well, let's play one that actually is maybe one of the most mainstream bands, but back in 1991 wasn't as well known. And that is, of course, Metallica. And here is their hit from that year, Enter Sandman. It's still great 30 years later, I have to say.
The absolute thing you can say about it is that it rocks.
It does. Well, I have a soft spot for Metallica. I know that sounds sure. weird for a heavy metal band to say I have a soft spot for them, but I do. And tell us why that song, that album took off and basically defined the era.
Well, they had released a number of records prior to that that were a little more influenced by kind of punk rock. And their previous record, Injustice for All, was the first one that really kind of made inroads on American commercial charts. So everybody was highly anticipating this record. And so when it finally came out in the summer of 1991, people were ready for it to kind of really explode and sort of bring a new renaissance for that style of heavy metal music.
Okay, moving on to a similar band, Pearl Jam, and here's a bit from Even Flow. Okay, that's from the album 10. And of course, Pearl Jam went on to become a mega band. What was it about that album that was their turning point?
Well, so it was their debut album. And it came out a couple weeks after Metallica. So there was starting to become the sense that there was this new form of heavy rock music that was coming out. They're one of the bands that kind of get lumped into the grunge movement, although probably among the more polished of them. Within the college radio world, it did not make an impact on American charts until the following year, 1992. It took a while. Their first two singles, including Even Flow, didn't make the U.S. charts at all. It was Jeremy that was their first hit, but that wasn't until 92.
Did you play that song?
We did. You know, it came out on Epic Records. It was a major label release. You know, a lot of college rock stations were a little bit wary of major label releases, wanting to just sort of spend more of their airtime on sort of the lesser known bands. But, you know, there was a recognition that this was a sound that was captivating. And as I mentioned, there was starting to become this new heavy rock sound that incorporated kind of the from a generation that listened to their parents' classic rock records, but also from their own experiences with punk rock and kind of melded the two to create something that was different and was more personal, maybe more political. And so we recognized that it was something that people were going to be interested to hear. And we were, of course, terribly excited when the mainstream sort of caught up with that idea.
So how does Guns N' Roses fit into that scene?
So Guns N' Roses was a local band in Southern California, part of the Sunset Strip scene. But they were different from bands, say, like Motley Crue or Warrant. It wasn't just simply a kind of a party band. They were a little more thoughtful in sort of their approach. Axl Rose had a real troubled young life. He actually grew up in the same city I did, in Lafayette, Indiana. I actually beat him out here to LA by a couple of years, but by the time he got out here, and established the band.
He didn't ask you to be in the band?
He didn't. No, he was a few years older than I and was sort of running around with a juvenile delinquent crowd that I was a little too good in two shoes for. They did release their Appetite for Destruction album that was sort of their big hit record with, you know, Welcome to the Jungle and whatnot. And that was sort of a groundbreaking record for sure. It was a number of years later before they kind of released the second salvo, and it was even more just sort of a bigger deal in the fact that it was Use Your Illusion, and it came in two double albums. There was Use Your Illusion 1 and Use Your Illusion 2, both of which were huge sellers. Actually, Part 2 reached number 1. Part 1 only actually reached number 2 on the pop charts.
Okay, let's hear a little bit from You Could Be Mine off the Use Your Illusion release. Okay, that's enough of that. Let's move on to Nirvana, of course. Cannot talk about this era without talking about Nirvana. And here it is, Come As You Are. Come, dust and mud, sand and bleach, as I want you to be. As a trend, as a friend, as a Eric, I understand you actually met Kurt Cobain when you were at the UCLA radio station.
Yes, it was actually for their previous record, their debut record, which was on Sub Pop Records, a record called Bleach from a couple of years prior. And they had come to the station, was part of their touring regiment to visit sort of the local stations. And, you know, we had no idea that they were going to become as massive as they were. I don't know exactly what Teen Spirit is supposed to smell like, but those dudes were the stinkiest guys I ever encountered. They smelled like they had just been living in their van for the past 9 months, smelled of cigarette smoke and stale fast food and sweaty clubs. And that was sort of my most sensory memory of the encounter.
I see.
But what was interesting was that the Nevermind record was when they were signed to Geffen. It was scheduled to come out in September the 24th. And part of the reason that date was selected is because that was at a point at which colleges were back in session. The record label pretty much only considered it to be a college rock success. And so they delayed its release to that point to be able to take advantage of that. UCLA being on the quarter system came out a little bit later, so we had it for a while before we were really ready to play it. But we could tell that it was going to be a great record, and it was astonishing how it was so picked up so rapidly and became the mainstream success it was. The record label did not anticipate that, and that led to an incredible sea change in the way that major labels sort of looked at signing new artists. In the hope of finding the next Nirvana. I mean, that was literally the phrase that was going around.
Right. It was kind of like a gold rush up in Seattle, right? People just looking for the next one.
It was probably the last gasp for traditional record label behavior before the streaming age really kind of put a dent in all of it.
Well, the last band we're going to talk about is another local band, the Red Hot Chili Peppers. And here is a bit of Give It Away from their 1991 record, Blood, Sex, Sugar, Magic. If I tuned into K-Rock, I would hear the song today. This is like an evergreen.
It's a legacy track at this point. It's a legacy album. And again, released on the same day, September 24th. It was that first moment that the college, the records that were being expected to be successes at college were being sent out. They being a local band, they had a whole series of records prior to that. They were a little less sort of hard rock per se. They had a lot more sort of funk element to them that kind of made them fun. And distinctive. They had an earlier record produced by George Clinton of funkadelic fame. But this was sort of their first big mainstream success. One thing that is interesting to note, all five of these bands that we're talking about, mostly due to the success of these important records, they're all inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. This was a very essential moment in sort of music history, and especially for those of us in the college radio world, where we were kind of finally being taken seriously as being able to recognize the talents of these bands before they kind of hit the mainstream.
Yeah. But a little bittersweet, though, don't you think? Because when you listen to this music, I mean, it is so big. It is so mainstream. It doesn't really have any of the revolutionary spirit of indie music or college radio stations in it.
Yes. I mean, some of it is a contextual thing, to listen to these records and knowing what had come before and how different they sounded then was something. I mean, I think Nirvana still remains the gold standard of a band that often attempted to be duplicated, but no one has ever quite matched the magic of what Kurt Cobain was able to sort of put in terms of these personal introspective sorts of ideas combined with a very vibrant sound, a very energetic performance. But you're right in the sense that there is sort of this sense that this was a last hurrah for the college rock moment, to really feel like we were doing something truly quote unquote alternative, not just simply the industry's idea of an alternative.
Eric J. Lawrence, reminiscing about that seminal year, 1991. He's KCRW music critic. Eric, thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
Coming up, Chinese director Chloe Zhao won an Oscar for her film Nomadland last night. Why China scrubbed any mention of that on social media? That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
And the Oscar goes to Chloe Zhao, Nomadland.
Chloe Zhao became the first woman of color to win Best Director for Nomadland, a film she also wrote. It was cause for celebration here in Hollywood, but in China, where Zhao was born, her win was largely censored. The state-run media barely reported on the Oscars, and mentions of Zhao's huge night are reportedly being scrubbed from the internet and social media in China, a country that has been collaborating with Hollywood to make blockbuster films for years. Joining us to talk about this is Anne Kokas. She's the author of Hollywood Made in China. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Madeline.
Well, okay, so this was a big win for China, really. And so why wouldn't they want to celebrate that?
So I think that here it's really important to distinguish the Chinese government from the Chinese people. So from the perspective of the Chinese Communist Party, this isn't necessarily a really big win, because Zhao has gone on the record being critical of China in a 2013 article in Filmmaker magazine. She talked about China as a place where that was full of lies. But it is an amazing win for Chinese filmmaking communities. And I attended the Beijing Film Academy. I'm sure that there are a lot of people who are in the filmmaking world in China who are really excited. However, their comments are being suppressed.
Right. And so let's listen to a little bit of what Chloe Zhao said as she accepted her Oscar.
When I was growing up in China, my dad and I used to play this game. We would memorize classic Chinese poems and texts, and we would recite it together and try to finish each other's sentences. And there's one that I remember so dearly. It's called The Three Character Classics.
And then she goes on to say the moral of that classic is that people at birth are inherently good. So a real heartwarming story. And so what do you make of what she said in that speech and how it may have been received in China?
So I think this is really interesting because on one hand, it is a Chinese classic. It's a 13th century Chinese classic. But the part that's really interesting is that it's not actually taught in schools anymore in China. It's been replaced by patriotic party education. So while Zhao was talking about that, it may appeal to Chinese people who still teach their children this at home, or people in Taiwan or in Hong Kong. But in terms of a direct appeal to the Chinese government, it doesn't play that way.
And so this reversal of China's on the part of how it's receiving Zhao, that happened fairly quickly, because when the Golden Globes, when she won that, they were very, very happy. And I guess that's when the news of this interview came out, that she apparently disparaged China by saying it was a place where there are lies everywhere, even though that comment, I believe, had been removed from the website. It was that comment in particular that inspired this change of feeling on the part of the government?
Well, I think that we can actually see it as occurring on two levels. So I think that there was political pressure from the top, but then there was also bottom-up pressure from Chinese netizens who pushed back against seeing this comment and against Zhao for being insufficiently patriotic.
And the Oscars weren't even shown in China last night, right? Was that because of her?
So that's a complicated question to assess. It may have been in part because of Chloe Zhao, but the more likely outcome of that is that there was a film in the best documentary shorts that was about the Hong Kong protests that showed very graphic upfront footage of what the Hong Kong protests look like and what the democracy protesters are fighting for. And I think that there was a lot of concern on the part of Chinese regulators that there would be discussion about the film, that the filmmakers might win and use their platform to advocate for the position of democracy protesters in Hong Kong. So there were two central issues there.
Aha. Okay. And so meanwhile, though, there is in other movies that have not been nominated, there's been a lot of collaboration between Hollywood and China. So given the tensions between the United States and China over trade issues and others, and given this involving the Oscars, how do you anticipate that being affected, if it is going to be affected? That relationship.
Well, this is going to be a really interesting thing to watch play out, because a film like Nomadland doesn't need to be distributed in China to recuperate its investment. And frankly, it probably, given the conditions under which it was made, I don't know that it was necessarily made for its financial recuperating finances anyway. However, Zhao's next project is a Marvel Cinematic Universe film called The Eternals, which in order to recuperate its budget will need to be distributed in China and will need to be successful there. So it's a very, very different level of pressure. And there is an increasing level of tension, as you noted, in between the US and China. And Chloe Zhao in particular has become a lightning rod in this relationship as well. So it remains to be seen if she'll stay on as the director, if the film will get made, if the film will be distributed in China, and if it is, if it's able to be successful. So there are a lot of different questions. And I don't think that the Oscars really necessarily move the needle one way or the other in that respect.
Interesting. Well, so meanwhile, there's a whole reshuffling here in the United States in terms of where movies are going to be seen, if they're going to be seen in theaters or, you know, going forward, or remain in people's homes on streaming. And is that affecting the relationship between Hollywood and China?
So that, I think, has a lot of really interesting second order effects. So first of all, what that means is that the Chinese box office, the theatrical box office, will likely be the largest in the world for the second year in a row. So it was, for the first time in 2020, the world's largest theatrical box office. And because U.S. theaters haven't fully reopened yet, it likely will be so in 2021. So the question becomes, will filmmakers start to make their theatrical releases primarily for the Chinese market, depending on how things happen in the U.S.? The other question is, how much will this year and a half long closure shape U.S. viewing practices?
Yeah. All right. Well, we shall see. Anne Kokas, author of the book Hollywood Made in China. Thank you. And that'll do it for us here at Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.